And we're talking about the sun, solar cataclysm. Lawrence Joseph, our special guest. When we come back, let's get a little bit more information about how the sun activity, for example, could be a predictor of global warming. And I definitely want to get into the prophecy of Edgar Cayce and what he says about sunspot activity as well. Okay, welcome back. Lawrence Joseph with us. Lawrence, you had mentioned the sun and skin cancer, and I didn't want to sweep right over that. Tell me again about that relationship.
Well, imagine that the sun is throwing zillions of microscopic darts.
All right.
And most of them are blunted or neutralized, however you like to think of it, in by the atmosphere, by the Earth's atmosphere. But some of them get through. Most of them, if they hit you, are harmless. But every now and then, one will score, let's say, an outer ring on the bullseye. And that will cause genetic damage and lead to the mildest form of skin cancer, basal cell skin cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of, thank God, most of us, if we suffer from it, we'll get that one, and it's curable and doesn't lead to permanent disfigurement or anything, you know, seriously. But for every 10 cases of that, there might be one case of squamous cell skin cancer, and that's more serious. If it hits the mucous membrane, it's harder to remove, and it can spread more, and that might lead to some serious surgical needs.
Yet the sun does have healing properties to it, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The sun heals and the sun makes us ill. And the sun is the complete 360.
All right. Too much makes you ill. A little bit makes you better.
Yeah. And we've reacted so much to the threat of skin cancer that the idea that the sun can actually heal you is almost heretical in our culture these days. I mean, there have been cases where dermatologists who recommend simply that someone get 10 or 15 minutes of morning sun to increase their vitamin D production just for their general well-being have been dismissed from their positions at universities. I mean, we've got like a witch hunt going on now to protect against skin cancer, which is a noble goal, but it's, you know, the old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And can you imagine the lawsuits that would occur if, as they do frequently in China, all the patients who can be carted out the door are sat out in the morning sunshine for an hour or two, between 8 and 10 a.m., I think, is the time they like to do it, and then brought back in for their health and well-being. I just can't imagine the scene at a U.S. hospital where they would do that, because the sun has been demonized. It's we seem to lurch from one overreaction to another, from a suntan culture where, you know, people go and lie in sun beds and broil themselves and run around in bikinis all day, and to a point where the idea of getting a little bit of morning sunshine is considered lethal or potentially.
Sure. So. Now, what about the sunshine producing vitamin E, which, you know, a lot of us take as supplements?
Well, vitamin D comes in is the sunshine vitamin. It's you can get it as supplements, but the form vitamin D3, I believe it is, that is produced in your skin by sunshine, is the best and most effective form. You can't simply take a pill and get the same result, or drink vitamin D milk and get the same result. It's funny to think, but we are photosynthesizers, not like plants. We're not green, but we use the sun to get vital nutrients, and vitamin D, particularly D3, is one of them. There's been a craze recently where now people take vitamin D supplements, and the National Institute of Medicine came out with a lengthy comparison of findings and found that that's being overdone. And it may well be that people are taking too much in the way of vitamin D in pill form. But vitamin D3 as created directly by the sun is another matter entirely.
True. How about Edgar Cayce, the great American prophet, the late great? What did he say about sunspot activity?
Well, Edgar Cayce said something highly unusual about sunspot activity. He said that it's affected by the emotional state of people on the earth. For the life of me, I can't figure out how that would work. But as it happens, one of your listeners wrote me this morning, Dr. Burl Payne.
All right.
Who's, you know, very serious fella, whose website examines how the emotional state, our emotional and meditative state here, can in fact affect the sun's behavior. This is on the edge of my boogie-boogie meter. I just don't know any scientific explanation for it. It intrigues me, and I do know that there's a fabulous independent scientist named Robert Pasichnik, who wrote the several books about how the Earth, not necessarily our human emotions, but the Earth and the planets can affect the sun, because the sun is much more susceptible to gravitational pulls than we are to it, because we're basically a solid mass, whereas the sun is more, as we were discussing earlier, gelatinous, and therefore kind of it responds more to gravitational tugs. So the alignment of the planets can in fact perturb the sun and cause sunspots, at least according to this theory. So Edgar Cayce is not so far out of a scientific, not mainstream, at least a plausible alternative. But what makes me interested in what Cayce has to say, aside from the fact that I think he's just a great man and a great healer, is he caught on to something about the Earth's magnetic field, which is what protects us from the sun, that none of the scientists of his time did, and that is now bearing to be not only true, but vitally important. He said the Earth's magnetic field was depleting, was getting weaker. The shields are down, Scotty.
Well, that may be.
Yes. There's lots of evidence. In fact, on December 15, 2008, a squadron of five solar research spacecraft from NASA flew quite unexpectedly through a hole in the Earth's magnetic field, a pole-to-equator breach in our magnetic field.
That's dangerous, isn't it?
Damn straight.
I remember the opening of the movie The Core, where that was happening, and the San Francisco Bridge collapsed because of it.
Yeah.
In the movie.
Yeah. I'm not sure what the direct consequence would be for our physical structures, but Lord knows you don't want the magnetic field to go down when the solar blasts are coming at your power grid or anything else. I mean, it is our first and only line of defense.
Scary, isn't it?
Yeah, and Cayce picked this up, 60 years ago?
Yeah, at least.
So, you know, I always think, give genius the benefit of the doubt. Even if you don't understand how they got there, be humble in the presence and regarding their opinion. So
let's go to Michael in Los Angeles. Get things going here with calls. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good, Michael.
Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to clarify some things just on the birth of our sun that you guys were talking about earlier. Now, I'm not a scientist, but I was sent by NASA to Caltech for excelling in my astronomy class, and we were studying through the Spitzer Infrared Space Telescope, specifically on the birth of protostars in the nebula. Now, you guys were talking about the dust clouds and the galaxies, and they start from there, and you're talking about the sun being in the middle of the cloud, which isn't necessarily true, okay? I mean, these nebula are huge, okay? We're talking light years across. Now, in certain spots, there's a little bit more density than other spots. Now, gravity starts to coalesce. They start to spin. It collects more, and gravity gets so intense that these atoms are getting pushed so hard that eventually they create nuclear fusion, and bam, you have a sun. and then they grow. And then when it gets, when it starts to create fusion, it solar wind blows the dust away, and what you have left are the other pieces of rock and iron material that coalesce into the planets around.
What happened to the rest of the nebulae?
It gets blown away, or also the rest of the nebula, there's it's so big and there's so many stars being developed in one nebula. We're talking hundreds of thousands of stars in a nebula, and there's tons of nebulas in each galaxy. Okay, they're all over the place.
Is there a smaller unit within the nebula because...
I'll give you an example. We were studying in the Gum Nebula, specifically the region in the Gum Nebula called SA101. Okay, so there's different regions that they might zone in on, but you'll have these the stars that start to create nuclear fusion. It blows away the dust, but they're so far away from each other. Our nearest star is 4 light years away. I mean, that's a long distance in human terms.
24 trillion miles.
How far is that in miles?
24 trillion.
24 trillion miles. Yeah, and that's the nearest star, right? So you think about the stars that are 100 light years away. But even 100 light years away, that's potentially still in the same nebula. Some of these nebulas are thousands of light years across. So you have one star that creates its nuclear fusion, and it blows away the extra dust, but the rest of the dust in there gets collected in planets and stuff, and that happens with all the stars. So it's using all of its material within it. Some of it gets blown away, but a majority of it gets sucked in, from the gravity.
All right. Well, interesting theory, which is probably very possible, Lawrence.
Absolutely. I appreciate the clarification.
Let's talk a little bit about the sun and its role on climate change. They talk about the things heating up. Could they be heating up because of the sun? Is heating up?
Well, that's a highly political question.
But is it possible?
The answer is yes. I attended a solar research conference at the University of Colorado several years ago, and there was a handout, a general informational handout, and I was leafing through it, waiting for the conference to begin. And on page 4, buried in some paragraph, was a statement that up to 30% of global warming can be accounted for by the sun's increase in solar activity over the last 150 years. And I'm like, This is what you're burying in a paragraph on page 4 of a little handout. This is highly important. This is a solar physics conference, so presumably they know their sun. And at the coffee break, I began asking around, why isn't more being made of this? And it was another example of the road to hell is being paved with good intentions. The scientists there, to a man, and they were almost all men, didn't want their findings about the solar activity and its relationship to global warming to be abused by polluters who would say, since the sun's closing it anyway, we can go ahead and spew as much gas into the air as we want. And I wish that they would just provide the information and not make policy decisions for all of us, because this is important to know. And in fact, if you tell me that 30% or so of global warming is caused by the increased activity of the sun, I say, then we can only control the remaining 70%, which makes it all the more imperative to do what we can, because We have a smaller area of influence to begin with, so we must work that much harder. But it turns out that over the last 150 years, the sun has been spiking in activity. That graph I began talking about at the beginning of the show, I was just looking at it. If you look back all the way to the end of the last ice age when it melted, you see a tremendous spike in solar activity, huge. Off the charts. Could it be that the sun's activity helped melt the ice age on Earth? One would have to assume there's some relationship. Then you see up and down, until the second largest spike is the one that began about 150 years ago in 1850 or so, and continues through today. And yet another period of global warming, not as dramatic as the one that melted the ice age, but still, nonetheless, very powerful situation. The problem is the debate has become so highly politicized, where scientists bury hugely important facts in nondescript little handouts, and where it's almost you'd be taken as a global warming naysayer by even bringing up. I'm not a Democrat or a Republican, but I have to say that the Democrats have done some really stupid stuff, deriding as stupid the idea that sunspots could be contributing to global warming. I've seen some of their press releases about it. Their earnest intention is to keep the greenhouse gas issue alive and important and continue to make progress towards curbing those emissions.
Well, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist just to figure it out that something's happening to the sun, and it's going to affect us.
Absolutely not. All our power comes from the sun. So if that power source fluctuates, or in this case spikes, it's going to have a consequence for us.
Let's go to Hawaii. David's with us. Hey, David, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Aloha, George and Lawrence.
You too.
I find it truly ironic that the theme of your show tonight surrounds the subject regarding the sun, sunspots, and solar flares. Excuse me, because the station in Hawaii that you're coming across to us on now, 6:70 a.m. I just called earlier today to find out why we were experiencing technical difficulties between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. While listening to my baseball games, et cetera, et cetera. However, I spoke to a very intelligent and informative lady, a key employee at the station, who told me that this interference occurred from solar flares and sunspots about this time every year.
Interesting.
Yeah. Strangely enough, this, however, didn't affect satellite FM or UHF rays, but AM waves, sounding like someone hit a bad string on a guitar, boing, or when you hit the key on your computer and when you want it to do something and it tells you, wrong, you can't do that, something like that. It was just very strange. I just called today.
Okay, well, we haven't had any solar flares over the last few days.
Yeah, well, the last couple of days, we've been getting interference down here from the baseball games and the news broadcasts and things like that. But it's not affecting the FM stations. And I just called to ask the station what's going on. And this is what she told me.
Okay, well, what do you think of that, Lawrence, even though there haven't been any solar flares of the last week or so?
Usually the kind of disturbance that the gentleman is referring to is in the ionosphere, which is the outer part of the atmosphere, the Earth's atmosphere.
Let's get more of that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Jeffrey Mishlove joins us as we talk about a little bit of mind over matter. When we come back, more of your phone calls with Lawrence Joseph as we talk about solar cataclysm on Coast to Coast AM. Lawrence, we were right in the middle about talking about solar activities around Hawaii, but there have been no solar activities, so what's going on?
I'm not sure that the person at the station had the proper explanation for their troubles.
Not for this case, at least.
Yeah, I mean, it would probably be more widespread. I think a lot of times there are electrical disturbances in the ionosphere that affect radio wave transmission, and that's something that could be caused by or stimulated by a solar flare hitting us or an explosion hitting us, but there are many other causes. I think that this is not in our category. George, I need a favor from you.
Yeah, what do you need?
I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times a couple of years ago trying to get the Senate to do something to protect our power grid, and No, they didn't listen to me. Big surprise. But from you, I really need your help in injecting this question of protecting our power grid into the political debate of the next 4 or 5 weeks.
What do you want me to do?
I want you to use your ingenuity and influence to propose that question to the moderators. Of the there's three debates left, one vice presidential and
two presidential.
Yeah. I'll write it up. I'll support you in any way I can.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right, we'll try to get it to him. All right, let's go to first-time caller Frederick in Rocky Mountains, Colorado. Hey, Frederick, go ahead.
Hey, actually, I've called before. I just wanted to...
You've called before, then how are you on the first-time caller line? How did you do that?
Wild card line.
No, you call the first-time caller line, but that's okay. Well, go ahead.
I know one thing. I pushed the redial button, so...
Well, that means...
It wasn't the first time.
No, that's right.
But what you said about Las Vegas, just the other day, I was down in the basement sleeping, and when the sun came out from behind the clouds, about 10 or so, both I and my niece woke up at the same time, and we had had plenty of sleep. I believe it definitely had something to do with the sun, and... I believe that also because I've noticed it, not every day, but every day that it's applicable, that when the sun comes out from the clouds, it doesn't matter where I am, you know, underground, in a building, or whatever, I can feel it because suddenly I feel a whole lot more energy.
You're sensitive to it.
Yeah, maybe you're part of the 15% who respond.
It doesn't happen a lot, but when it does, hey, so be it.
Source of happiness for you, I imagine.
Let's talk a little bit about the Mayan calendar date of December 21st, 2012. What do you think is going to happen, Lawrence?
Well, as you might know, I wrote a book called Apocalypse 2012 that looked into that a bit. And
that's right.
I went down to Guatemala to work with Mayan shamans who... were interpreting that prophecy. And I liked, you know, just because it says on the internet that the ancient Maya predicted something doesn't mean that the ancient Maya predicted it. Just, somebody can write it and then everybody copies it and all of a sudden it becomes a false fact, if you would. But when I went down there, they said that December 21st, which is the winter solstice, this particular December 21st, 2012, the sun will eclipse, that is to say, interpose itself between the dead center of the Milky Way galaxy and the Earth. And I thought, okay, I can live with that. I mean, so what? And from their due diligence, these shamans I work with had themselves spent 20 years going around the former Mayan kingdom talking to sages and shamans and elders just what the prophecies were. They believe that it's striking a midnight chord, and the best analogy that they came up with is, you know how when the power goes off in your house and then it comes back on, certain things need no tending to, but
that's those, right,
you know, like the clock and the DVR or something, you need to reset manually. This was their analogy for the eclipse, the effect of the eclipse on us being disconnected momentarily from the womb of the Milky Way galaxy, as they put it. I said, okay, but what does it mean in actuality? What's the bottom line here? And then they believe that this is the birth of a new era. And like any other birth, it'll be accompanied by joy, blood, and pain. And I was interested in the blood and pain part. You don't have to prepare for joy. It's the blood and pain part that had me hooked, because if there's blood and pain coming, I don't say necessarily there is, but this is their prophecy, and this is the beginning of a new era, how do we defend ourselves? And that gets into quite a bit of spiritual philosophy, which I don't know how closely it relates to our discussion at hand, but I do note that their idea is that the behavior of the sun, the movement of the sun, will cause cataclysmic change in our society. As it happens, December 21st, 2012 is right about the beginning point of the next solar climax, which again is the time when the sun's storms are the most frequent and ferocious. And all we need is for one of those storms to explode a plasma bomb on us. The coronal mass ejection is the proper term, but plasma bomb is more descriptive. Get hit by one of those suckers, and our power grid goes down.
That's right.
So maybe it's all coincidence.
I'm going to talk with you about these surge suppressors in just a moment. Go west, Thomas, in Monterey, California. Go ahead, Thomas. Thank you.
Hi. Yeah. I'm a engineering student out here, and I've been doing a little bit of research with plasma, and I'm wondering if there's any way that we could use a solar eruption to our advantage somehow, if there's a way to capture some of that energy to help the situation instead of, we're talking about huge levels of energy. I recognize it's probably going to completely fry a lot of systems, but is there a possibility that we could use this somehow to our advantage?
Well, I'd love to come up with a bright suggestion there. I've not seen anybody come up with a constructive approach because the blasts are so intermittent and unpredictable as to when they're going to come that you need a constant state of readiness to respond. Moreover, the actual voltage that hits the surface of the Earth, if indeed that's where we plan our interception, is pretty minor, really pretty minor. So I guess the short answer is I can't think of any, but you asked a good question, and, you know, knock wood, you'll come up with an even better response.
Let's talk about these surge suppressors that you say are pretty affordable, I would think, based on what we've spent before on other things. How would it work?
Pretty simple. Understand that a coronal mass ejection, which is this plasma bomb from the sun, comes in. Usually it's repelled by the Earth's magnetic field and cycled around into the Van Allen radiation belts. But big ones, or when the Earth's magnetic field is down, as ours appears to be these days, big ones blast through, hit the surface of the Earth with electromagnetic radiation, goes into the ground, then it pops back out. A little bit of it pops back out. Not so much that we would feel it, no one would get a shock or anything like that. But it comes back out, and it unfortunately fuses solid and destroys the transformers that are the nodal points of the grid. Basically, transformers take huge voltages, 750,000 volts, for example, and step them down into 5 150,000 volt lines. It's that conversion process is the weak point, the vulnerability of our grid. And what happens is the little currents that come up from the solar blast get into the transformer and fuse the copper winding solid. What we need to do is to prevent this from happening is to stick the surge suppressor between the ground and the transformer, a little bit of protection. Why is it so important to protect the transformers? It's not only because when they go down, they go out. You can't just send a utility crew to fix them. They weigh more than 100 tons. They're copper winding fused solid. They have to be replaced. As it stands in right now, there's a 3-year waiting list in the world market for transformers, the largest ones. And none of them are made in the United States anymore.
No, most of them China, right?
China and Brazil and India as well. Yeah, so we would be at the mercy of potential political adversaries to restart our economy. You can't just say, okay, let's go and build a couple hundred transformers and stick them in a warehouse for a rainy day, because the transformers have to be calibrated precisely to their spot in the grid. So it's not by any means one size fits all. And using the surge suppressors would make the difference between a totally cataclysmic situation and one that wouldn't be perfect, but would be perhaps inconvenient, because it wouldn't protect the grid entirely. Other transformers might go. some of the surge suppressors might malfunction, whatever, but it's the difference between a headache and having your head cut off.
That's a good point. Let's go to Beaverton, Oregon. Robert's with us on the wild card line. Hey, Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just listening earlier just now, and when you said about the blood and the pain, it's supposed to accompany the galactic alignment.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I was thinking that supposedly the 21st is when it's supposed to come to the climax and be the exact, like, alignment peak. But I heard that, like, it's been starting to rise in the black hole for a couple years now, right?
Yes.
So the 21st is, like, the last day, the peak, where it severs the connection with the universe, or whatever. That, as soon as that's over with, the blood and pain, I think, is already, we've been experiencing that for, what, 20, 30, 40 years? I mean, how horrible has the last few years been? I just think the 21st is going to be, like, done, and then we're going to be good to go after that.
I wonder what the Mayans knew all about that. You never know, Lawrence.
Well, God willing, that, I mean, if we're reaching the depths, let it happen soon, you know? I personally don't see that date, per se, as the actual pivot point so much as, you know, the center point for a process that's been underway and that will continue. By the way, the Maya are optimistic. We are entering the age that we're entering after the blood and pain part is supposed to be new and enlightened and wonderful and in unprecedented ways. So if you can hack your way through the hard stuff.
So there's upside for us.
Definitely. Definitely.
Tell us about the Little Ice Age. What happened?
The Little Ice Age is what kept us from conducting this interview in Icelandic or Old Norse. The Little Ice Age.
Yeah.
was pure and simple, 1300 to 1700, a downturn in solar activity and also a corresponding decline in global temperatures. And what happened, one of the consequences for us is that we were not colonized by the Vikings. How did this work? Preceding the Little Ice Age was something called the Medieval Warm Period, where it got warm, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere. And the Vikings were able to sail the Northern North Atlantic, which became free of ice for much of the year. And they made their way over to the coast of Canada and established Vinland, their colony, which they liked a lot because grapes were growing up there at the time. It was warm enough for grapes to be growing wild in Newfoundland. And they like grapes because you could make wine. So they had a very promising little import-export business, which could have, I'm sure they fully planned to colonize and expand and, you know, have a good time with their product. But then came the Little Ice Age.
Unexpectedly.
Yes. When the seas froze and became impassable and getting to the grapes was not so easy, and I'm sure the grapes didn't grow as well because everything got colder. And this, again, the Little Ice Age coincides very closely with the downturn in solar activity. In fact, there was a 70-year period called the Maunder Minimum from, I believe it was 1645 to 1715, where there were hardly any sunspots at all. The sun went blank for 70 years. And this was a time of cool, rainy summers and frigid winters and failed crops and famine and plague. Not what you look forward to. And so it's one thing to remember that difficult as global warming is, and it certainly is posing its challenges, global cooling is no picnic either. One of my favorite stories about the Little Ice Age, particularly the Maunder Minimum part of it, 1645 to 1715, is it almost exactly coincides with the reign of Louis XIV, Louis XIV, the Sun King. And the doctrine, the Catholic doctrine that he espoused, hated sunspots. Sunspots were seen as an imperfection in God's most perfect celestial creation, the sun. So any spots or blemishes or pimples on the face of the sun was like, couldn't be.
Right.
It was heresy. I mean, Galileo was tried and convicted for discovering and insisting upon the existence of sunspots. That was part of, a major part of his trial. So Louis XIV, who took it upon himself to represent the sun, certainly didn't want any spots on his face or on the face of his namesake. And in fact, they disappeared for all but the first 2 years of his realm, his reign. And I mean, I'm not a superstitious guy, but you know, Louis XIV, Sun King, comes, hates sunspots, sunspots go away. Yo.
Yeah, how does that work?
Yeah.
Let's go to Nikki in Rochester, Washington, west of the Rockies. Nikki, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, George?
Good, Nick.
Hey, it's Mickey, by the way. Sorry, guys.
Straight Mickey. Okay.
I have a question, and I'll take your answer off the air. And this might be kind of a dumb question, but if we know that one of these solar flares are heading our way, and it's going to fry our electrical grid, isn't there any way that we could just shut it down so that way it didn't get fried? Or are we basically just kind of SOL? If one of those things are coming our way, and I'll take it off the air. Thank you.
Well, if it's a big enough flare right now, we're up the creek.
Well,
don't you think, Lawrence?
Yeah. I mean, if it's like the 1859 flare,
X10, X15, something like that.
Yeah. But there's a lot of things we can do to minimize the damage. It's not a stupid question at all that Nikki poses, because
I wonder if that was Nikki 6. Nah. You never know. Go ahead.
There's all sorts of things that utility operators can do if they have the warning. Right now, we have about 1 million miles out in space, a satellite called ACE, whose job it is to send exactly those warnings, let us know, give us a couple hours advance notice. So,
well, that's why they throw the astronauts that are in the International Space Station in that little quarantine room, huh?
That's right. Yeah, it's hardened and it's protected. And the ACE satellite will give us the best possible read on where this thing is going to hit. And so operators in the target, the bullseye area, can shut down without shutting down the whole grid. There's lots of things that can be done if we have the advance notice. And if it's not, again, a huge 1859 style.
Lawrence, we're coming back. We're going to take a final hour with you on Coast to Coast AM and all phone calls. We'll be back.